Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
If we study human history, even a little bit, not necessary to be a scholar of history, but if we look at the record of human history, it shows us that human beings can be very uneven and very unpredictable in their relationships, in our relationships with each other. And history shows us that there are innumerable ways that we can be thoughtless, uncaring, and cruel. History records continuous outbreak of war, slavery in many parts of the world, theft, one country stealing from another, or one tribe stealing from another, deprivation. Human beings create a lot of suffering. Yet, at the same time, we do have the capacity for kindness and generosity and self-sacrifice. So there are two spiritual traditions that I'm familiar with, and maybe you too, maybe you know of more than two, but the two religious traditions that I've had some exposure to, they both say that human beings are fundamentally perfect. So in the Judeo-Christian tradition, in the book of Genesis, it says that human beings were put on the earth in a world of perfection. They had everything. Were placed in a garden of abundance, and everything was in perfect harmony. Everything was just right. But human beings became distracted when they were tempted to have one more thing. It seems like those human beings are unaware of the perfection, of the inherent perfection of the world we live in, the inherent perfection of our surroundings. So we give in to temptation because we think we need more. So in the Genesis story, humans got into trouble when they ate the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So by risking everything for one more thing, the story tells us that mankind loses itself and its wholeness. And alienates itself from its environment. You know, in that story, man is kicked out of the Garden of Eden, alienated from its inherent perfection. And life on earth becomes one of difficulty and sorrow. And mankind persists in the habit of desiring one more thing. Well, that's where we are today. Even though we started off perfect, still desiring more. So I always wondered, how does good and evil, both, come into an inherently perfect world? World already enlightened. What is it that destroys the peace of the perfect world? What is it that sets the things of life against themselves? Why do we set the things of life against themselves? By discriminating them, by separating them into categories, good and bad, like and dislike. Being separated into categories is not the fundamental nature of the things of the world. And that's the problem. We separate the things of the world into categories, and that's not their nature. Good versus bad, like versus dislike. That's the problem. Our human tendency to discriminate and judge the things of our world. We have the tendency to want to know things and people as either good or bad, and objects and people that we like or dislike. And so the cause of our suffering is our judging mind that leads to desires, the forbidden fruit. Now, Buddhism says the same thing as Genesis, except maybe in less dramatic fashion. Buddhism says that suffering and dissatisfaction comes from our desires and our distractions, and our ignorance. Ignorance being, in the case of Buddhism, our misunderstanding of the true nature of things. Ignorance. Not intellectual ignorance, but misunderstanding the true nature of the things of our world. Foolishness. Humans suffer because of foolishness, misunderstanding. And this misunderstanding causes us to allow the temptation and desire to obscure the true nature of things, to obscure reality. But our being foolish, our ignorance, being foolish is not inherently bad or evil. We don't need to judge foolishness. In the Bible, it's called original sin, the choice that the humans make to want one more thing. And to violate the command not to do that. But they do it. That's called the original sin. And it's based on an act of disobedience. And so the humans are punished because they were disobedient. And that seems overwhelming and harsh. I remember first learning the story of Genesis and how Adam and Eve are kicked out of the Garden of Eden and have to suffer. All human beings then have to suffer forever. Seems really harsh. gosh. That's when I started having doubts about religion. But anyway, to punish human beings in that way, seems to reflect a concept of a fundamental deformity in human beings. You know, the story says you'll never be happy again. You'll always suffer. Go out in the world, you'll always suffer. There's no way. You are fundamentally deformed. That's the impression I got from that story. But that's not the Buddhist understanding. Are we always overwhelmed with desire for one more thing so that we suffer? Is that inherent in us? So, if we want to appreciate our inherent perfection and relieve our suffering, we need to address the question or the problem of original foolishness, not original sin. Original sin is a stain forever, you know. Original foolishness is something you can get over. The point of our practice is to look carefully at our original foolishness. And so there's hope there. Because we can say to ourselves, I can overcome foolishness. Doesn't stain me permanently. So the foolishness that comes up in our everyday life because of our incomplete understanding of the world we live in and the life we're living, the foolishness that we act out in our everyday life means we will make mistakes. We will make mistakes. And so our lives are full of mistakes. And how we respond to our mistakes is vital, is really important. And this is an inherent feature of our practice. How we respond to mistakes and how we understand their origin. But the point is, we need to understand that our mistakes, whenever they come up, are an expression of foolishness rather than as a result of some kind of congenital malice. Just foolishness, which can be a burden, but it's just foolishness. When we can accept that our mistakes are a product of misunderstanding or poor judgment or foolishness rather than some kind of inherent evil, you know, then we have the possibility of letting them go. And we can avoid taking them personally. So if we make a mistake, there's no need to say, oh, I'm such a bad person. I'm inherently evil. That's foolish. We make a mistake and we say, oops, made a mistake. I was foolish then. I'll have to watch it. So if we can recognize the mistakes of our life as expressions of foolishness we can avoid taking them personally and not have them cast a shadow over our life. And all of this starts with accepting the truth that we do have a tendency to be foolish. We can't have perfect judgment all the time. When we have that acceptance of our tendency to be foolish, then we have a chance to respond to our mistakes with understanding and not grieving. Have you ever become angry with yourself because of some mistake you made? Well, don't raise your hand. I doubt if there is anyone alive who has not gotten angry with themselves because they made a mistake. The feelings about it can be very devastating. We can lose our equanimity. We can lose our sense of control. We can feel mental and physical pain because of the stress of the anger. And we run the risk of turning that angry feeling towards other people. And here's where the world gets into trouble. We are unaware that what we are doing is experiencing our mistake as some kind of evidence that we are fundamentally flawed. And then we extend that judgment to others. It's very mixed up. But what if we accept our mistake as an act of foolishness and see it as simply the result of losing our awareness in a given situation and becoming distracted by something more exciting, something more entertaining, something more comfortable than what we are doing in the present moment. So if you're driving and you think, wouldn't it be fun to be looking at something on my phone? And you have an accident because you wanted some excitement rather than stick with what you got, which is driving. Distracted by something more exciting than what we're doing in the present moment. But if we see our mistake as an act of foolishness, we can avoid harsh judgment and denial and the cycle of anger. And avoiding that judgment about ourselves provides an opportunity to hold our mistake lightly and learn from it. Then we can reflect on what we said or did that was foolish, and what was the temptation that we gave into that caused us to make a mistake. What could we have done differently or said differently in the given situation? When we take our mistake through this kind of creative process and turn it into a positive experience, we can expand our wisdom. And of course, lessen the risk of a future mistake. our practice, we wrestle with our foolishness. We don't wrestle with inherent evil, anything like that. We respond to our inherent foolishness when a mistake is made. So there may be pain and suffering at that moment, but it opens the door to a creative process. To maintain good relationships with each other and with the world, if we make a mistake, there is no hesitation to offer an apology to anyone who might have been harmed or hurt. The apology is a way of expressing our desire to maintain the relationship. And it establishes the basis for a higher level of trust. In other words, our personal relationships go beyond the polite and the superficial when we understand that all of us are at risk for acting foolishly, and that this is an everyday aspect of human nature. But it does not mean that we are fundamentally evil or imperfect. So when we can accept our own mistakes this way, it provides us the basis for responding creatively to the mistakes of others with understanding rather than reacting angrily. Let me tell you a story that I've told before, but it's one of my favorites, and it illustrates this point. It's about the boxer Joe Louis. Does any of you remember Joe Louis, the boxer? You know, he was the best. He was at his peak in the 1930s and 40s, and so that's a long time ago already. But when in the spring of the year 1940, Joe Louis was at the peak of his career. He dominated the boxing world. So one night in New York City on Broadway, in the warm night, warm spring night, he and his manager and his trainers were walking down Broadway after they had completed a nice dinner in a restaurant on Broadway. And while they were walking down Broadway, a drunk came up to them, a drunk who did not like black people. And this drunk started bothering them and getting very belligerent. The man screamed racist remarks at Joe Louis, and he cursed him, which of course it wasn't a very smart thing to do. But he was drunk, and he was foolish. Joe Louis was very well respected, not only for his skill, but for the quality of his character. He maintained the story that was reported in the paper was that Joe Louis maintained his equanimity in the face of this racist confrontation. And he restrained his manager and his trainers from intervening, because they all wanted to jump on this man and, you know, hurt him. Joe Louis just told him not to do that. So eventually the man went on his way, and Joe Louis and his group resumed their stroll down Broadway. And Joe Louis was heard to say, "Foolish fellow." That was his response to racism and insults. Foolish fellow. When we understand the mistakes of others as foolish acts, it provides us the basis for forgiveness and for compassion, because we don't take those mistakes personally. And this is true even when we are the target of injustice and cruelty. This is our practice. Seeing mistakes as foolishness prevents the mind from getting caught up in anger. And then moving on to clinging to fantasies of revenge and retribution. When we see the troublesome behavior of people in this way as something that comes out of foolishness and not out of an evil intent, the mind can stay calm and retain an opportunity to reflect. This is the most creative way to respond, to invent or some words that are troublesome. I heard a story about the Dalai Lama many years ago trying to send a message to the people of Tibet after they were invaded and occupied by the Chinese. He told them not to hate the Chinese soldiers who were occupying their country. Don't hate those soldiers. And he told them this out of concern for their future, out of concern for their emotional and spiritual well-being. Don't hate. Even though you're being treated with cruelty, don't hate. Normally we would say, how can we fight back? The Dalai Lama had a longer range view. He had a long view. Don't hate for your own spiritual well-being. That's hard to do. In the New Testament, if you read the New Testament, you come to Christ's final words, which are something like, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." So you would think that Christ is saying that to God, "Forgive them, they don't know what they're doing to me. They don't understand it." But those words of Christ were not meant for God. I mean, after all, God already knew about human beings. He didn't have to be told. Christ was speaking to ordinary people, saying, "Forgive them, they know not what they do." He's talking to everyday people, making one final effort to help them understand that even the worst kind of cruelty is a mistake based on foolishness. Forgive them, they know not what they do. They are being foolish. Unimaginable cruelty oh, they don't know what they're doing. Wow. He's talking to people. He's not talking to God. He's talking to people. Forgive them. We are full of desires, and we are subject to having delusions and temptations. And our practice warns of this, and then we learn of it from our own experiences. These desires and these temptations will cloud the mind and muffle the inner voice. And our delusions are immune to intellectual understanding, you know. They just sort of come up without our thinking about them. Wham, there they are. And how we balance our life, stabilize our life, while we are subject to temptations and desires and delusions, we need to engage our body and mind in selfless contemplative practice. And that's why we're here. And that's why we created this space. When we do that, when we commit to a selfless contemplative practice, we have a chance of letting our grasping mind come to rest. And then we can experience our spiritual quality and understand the meaning of our mistakes. Which is part of our enlightenment.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.